This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With the Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And it is very exciting. It is almost March, and I will be celebrating the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper. And I want to thank everyone who's already started sending me all sorts of notes, and also I've gotten some nice blurbs for my PR. I want to thank everyone for that. So if you have something you want to send to me, if you want to send me a nice note or a blurb that I can use in my PR for the 9th anniversary of Joy on Paper, I can't believe it. My goodness, the years have gone so fast. And you can just send it to me at Gmail. It's radio-joyonpaper@gmail. And I'd love to hear from you. Now, at the bottom of the hour, I have two things. I have a very special song we're going to premiere here on Joy on Paper from one of our favorite guests, Haley Woolbright. And when you hear this song, you're going to say, oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. A car company has to pick this song up. It is so much fun. But, you know, I love to have a diverse range of guests on the program. And over the years, you know, I've gone from, I've had so many wonderful guests. And it doesn't matter to me if they're global best-selling authors or even the poet laureate or if they're indie authors. And I love authors who have just come out with a new book. And I have one today, a debut author at the bottom of the hour. And I'm looking forward to talking to Patrice McDonough about her book. But right now I'm going to turn to an author who, oh my gosh, what is that? Oh my gosh, alarms. Oh, well, can you believe that? In the middle of a show. Well, anyway, life is exciting. We have today a guest, a very special guest. Jay, I hope I pronounced this right. Are you there, Jay?
Yes, I am.
Okay, is it Negaborn?
Nugaborn. Close.
Nugaborn. Okay, Nugaborn. All right, Jay. Yeah, that's great. And I am so happy to welcome you to Joy on Paper because it's very funny. I almost didn't take this book. But I will tell you, you have to really, it's Camus. But the minute I saw Camus, I have this love-hate relationship with Camus. When I was 13, I was caught reading Camus in my math class. And the teacher sent me to detention. Time out. She sent me out of the classroom because instead of doing math, I'm reading The Stranger. So after that, you know, every time I see the word Camus, I say, memories of that terrible teacher. But I am glad that I did accept you because, as I said, you have a wonderful, wonderful publicist. Authors don't realize that a publicist can make a big difference. And Rachel, your publicist, kept sending me letters. She said, you really, really should take this author. So I said, okay. So the name of your book is After Camus. And of course it does relate to the Camus, oh my goodness. I think a lot of people go through that Camus stage in their life. I've had authors who have done this. So you obviously went through it. You're still in it. But for people who don't know, Camus, of course, won the Nobel Prize back in, 1957, I think, right?
Correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, correct. So you were I have to have you explain the name of, you know, the premise of the book and stuff. But I just wanted to tell you that I love to have a diverse range of guests. And so this is, you know, it's a funny program because on the one hand, first of all, I had promised myself during the pandemic that I wouldn't do any plague books or any pandemic books or any books about medicine. I don't want. But at the bottom of the hour, I have a debut author who's written about the plagues in England back, you know, in Victorian times. So I want you to explain your book. It's a fascinating book. Well written, and I want to tell people, you know, one of the other reasons that I agreed to take on this book is when I saw that you've written so many books, and of course also you've appeared in the your essays have appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, American Scholar, I think New York Times, of course. But I for some reason the one that always gets me is I love O. Henry, and so you were also in O. Henry, right?
Oh yes, I was twice. Mm-hmm.
Twice. Oh well, then that means you're a good writer. So
like
tell us
so.
About your book and about today's the release date.
Today is publication day. Yes, it is.
Okay, so it's your big day. So tell us about it and just explain it to people and we'll encourage people to read it.
Well, it is the story of a marriage between two people who were both influenced by Camus in very significant ways. And one of the protagonists, Saul Davidoff, is a doctor, was an AIDS doctor mostly all through the AIDS pandemic, but he had been inspired when he was a medical student to go into infectious disease because of his reading of Camus' novel, The Plague. And his wife, Tully, is a woman who, when she was in her early 20s, was a dancer and choreographer who went to Paris specifically to meet Camus. And to conjure up a ballet which has the title Camus Visits Nijinsky's Grave. She has a liaison with Camus, as many women did in his short lifetime, and she is about to return to Paris, where she will meet with him again when, at the age of 47, Camus dies in a car accident. What the novel does is it takes these two people through 40 years of their marriage. Initially, they're drawn to each other for many reasons, including the fact that they've both been strongly influenced by Camus. Where most of the novel is set is in a small village in the south of France where Camus himself had lived for a year when he was recovering from a siege of tuberculosis. And they have gone to this village in order to see if they can renew their marriage, which has been falling apart. The novel spans 40 years of their marriage. They meet during a protest of the Vietnam War in New York City. Saul, the doctor, is returning to France, where the two of them lived when they were first in love, because he has written a letter to the President of the United States in which he calls him a murderer, because the president has withdrawn funds for AIDS research and treatment. And they go to this village in the south of France to see if they can renew their marriage. And that is essentially the arc of the story, which includes in the historical arc of the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, the AIDS pandemic, and while they are in this village, a political rally at which the right-wing Le Pen movement tries to rally the people in this village against immigrants. And during this rally, Saul cannot hold himself back. He cries out shame to the people who were basically yelling, "Get these people out of our lives," and he is beaten up. So that's, I won't tell you whether or not they do save the marriage, but it's essentially my attempt to describe a period of history that many of us Americans lived through from the 60s, 70s, 80s, and into our present time, with the politics in the background and the domestic situation, raising families, doing our jobs, in the foreground. And the question is, can people continue to be good friends, love each other in times of tremendous turmoil, political turmoil, which I would say we are living through again with the COVID pandemic and other events?
Well, it's like sometimes you think nothing changes. Just when you thought things would change, you know, we're now again fighting in the Ukraine. I remember, you know, thinking years ago, I mean, this kind of thing would never happen. And with Camus, of course, I remember that he was like one of the loudest voices against the Soviet invasion of Hungary. And just, I don't know, it's so strange, but you do really, your writing, of course, it's superior. It's like top-notch writing. You don't get writers like you every day, I can tell you. It is really great. And how you are able to capture the time, the place, the people. You know, a lot of people, they're going to see the name Camus and they won't, like, many people don't know anything about him. And they'll think, you know, it might be too, I don't know, I don't want to say this word, but sort of like too intellectual. But this is just a book about people and about human nature. And I think that, you know, it's just an easy read.
Well, thank you. I hope so. I hope that, first of all, I am a storyteller. I should also mention that Camus becomes a ghostly presence in the novel, and Tully, the woman, the wife, has these sort of imaginary dialogues with him all through the novel, which
is fascinating. It's great.
I enjoyed writing. And Camus, you know, was not only a writer and a man who spoke out against the invasion of Hungary, but his own life, which I sketch in at significant points, was fascinating. I mean, his father died when he was 2 years old, was killed in the war. His mother was illiterate, could not read a word. He grew up in Algeria. During World War II, he risked his life in Paris as a member of the resistance. He was editor of the newspaper Combat, which was the resistance newspaper. I mean, he was a fascinating man, and a very brave man. And he and his spirit informs the book, and we live up to our notions of how we should live. Can we be the best people we like to be? Our main characters struggle with this in terms of their relationship with their children, who are significant players in the novel, as you know, and in terms of the betrayals that they commit, let's say. They do betray one another with other people. And how does one survive? And how does one make a long-term marriage, here in this case 40 years? How do you make that work when you are torn by all kinds of forces that are, to some degree, beyond your control?
Yeah, you know, he's so deep. His writing is both deep and it's also right there. You can really understand what he was trying. He was looking for something, and he takes us, Camus took us on a journey, just as you take the readers on a journey. Having lived in Europe and traveled a great deal in France, we traveled everywhere. I've been on that road where he died.
My goodness.
Oh, yeah. One of the things that I did when I lived in Europe, my main interest was going to places where authors lived or were born. I mean, one of my best trips, of course, I moved to England because I wanted to live near where Jane Austen was born. So that's the kind of person I am. So, of course, I've been on that road. I think they've renamed it at the time. It had a different name, but so I think what you've done here is both, it's very clever, and as I said, your writing is top notch, and you are a storyteller, and I loved how you I love the idea of the ballet, and I got such a kick out of that. I thought that was just wonderful. How did you come out with this idea? I mean, you know, of course, you were reading Camus. When did you start reading Camus? I was 13 when I started reading Camus.
Well, you have me beat by 4 years. I first read Camus when I was 17. The Stranger, which I think is probably
okay.
The novel most people start with.
Yeah.
And I recall staying up late at night with my younger brother, who would have been 12 years old, and reading passages to him from The Stranger and talking about it with him.
Oh, I did the same with my sister. Now, my sister's quite a bit older than I am, and she had never read Camus. I remember, and this is so funny, because, as I said, I was reading it in math class, and you get at that point when you're reading The Stranger, the first time you're reading it, you do get sort of obsessed with it. And so then I read, when I told my sister, you know, what happened to me, and the teacher was so mean to me. So I read passages to my sister, and she turned to me and she said, oh my goodness. She said, I didn't realize you could understand all that. So I think it's wonderful. Oh, well, what a nice connection.
Yeah, oh, yeah. And then, I was fortunate enough in my own life to have lived for several years in the south of France.
So you know the road. So you know the road. What was it called? National 5, I think, or something.
Oh, National 95, I believe.
So you lived there, so... That really imbues a story with a lot of reality.
Well, of course, and I was having loved Camus, and then when I was in college, I took several courses where I read Camus in French for the first time. But then to have, and Camus died the year, actually, that I graduated from college, 1959, and to have someone so vital, a man with such a vital life, who was so, as the French say, engagé, so involved in life, there was nothing passive about him in his life, cut down in the prime of his life at 46 years old.
Yeah, he was so young.
Was the cruelty of that, to me, I think, I can't explain what that does to me, but it, the unlived part of years of his life, in some ways, maybe that's why to Tully in the book, he becomes a ghost, a presence who is still alive and with whom she communes, basically, when she's trying to figure out what to do about her life with her husband, about their children, one of whom comes to France because she's pregnant and wants to know whether she should or should not have the child. And she wants to talk with, she talks with each of her parents about this. She does not want to be with the man who fathered the child. So what should she do? So these are, there are really, I would say, existential questions, but they're also domestic questions. You know, how do you get along with someone day after day, year after year? What do you tell your child? Do you tell your child what to do? Or do you tell your child, you have to know what to do yourself?
Well, you know, I don't have much time, but I want to tell people that really, read After Camus. It's fascinating, well written, an enjoyable read, and you do come away, it's thought provoking, and I like that. It's called After Camus, and it's by Jay Nugaborn.
Yes,
okay. Okay. Do you have a website you want people to go to, or just they get it online?
They can get it online. They can go to the publisher, Madville Publishing, and order direct from the publisher.
Okay. Well,
A very handsome paperback or in a digital edition.
Well, Jay, funny. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. I think it's a fascinating book. It brought back a lot of memories for me about my time. My Camus years, I consider them like, I was like from 13 to about 21 were my Camus years. So, I was deeply involved. And again, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today.
My pleasure.
It was a joy to talk to you. Bye-bye now.
Thanks so much. Bye.
All right. Sometimes you need a book like this. It really makes you think. It makes you wonder, makes you, it's this excitement in it. Now we have, last week, Haley, Haley Woolbright was here, and we couldn't play one of her songs, but we're going to play it now. And when you listen to this song, you will know why I think some car company should pick her up. So let's play her wonderful minivan song.
A minivan all the way to Portland, Oregon, not Maine. We had no plans, me and my friends, trying to make the best spring break we had ever had. 30-hour drive cross country. When we got tired and had to stop, we pulled over and slept in a Denny's parking lot. Road tripping on the open road, a GPS that tells us where to go. There's nothing better than making memories and in a minivan. it by showering at truck stops.
What?
Driving up Pikes Peak in Colorado and sleeping in our hammocks in the forests of Utah. That bluest in Clark stop when we hit the ocean. The sun on the Pacific glowed. Too good to be true, waste time, it slowed. Road tripping on the open road. Or GPS.
And her music is available on everywhere where they sell music. Now we're going to have a book buzz from Bria Burton. And she is going to be the guest host next Tuesday. And this is a book buzz for one of her guests.
Hello, fellow sci-fi readers. This is author Bria Burton reporting for Joy on Paper with your science fiction book buzz. Today's communique to galaxies near and far includes a 2023 debut novel, Steel Fire from the Gods, by Clint Hall, with stellar narration by Adam Werner. Now, let's download the book buzz. In a dystopian future where AI machines have conquered humankind, Gunnar Graves hides the truth of his cybernetic heart for fear of reprisal from other human survivors. Ever since he lost his parents in the unwinnable battle against the machines, which were so adept at harnessing the Earth's elements that people called it elemental magic, Gunnar has been hearing voices and dreaming strange dreams. When a war machine arrives to kidnap a child from Gunnar's village, his rage awakens a power stirring within him. In the heat of anger, he terminates the machine and rescues the child. Instead of being hailed a hero, he's mistrusted by the village. If he can wield the same power as the enemy, what does that make him? His exile leads him to unexpected places and to people who have harnessed their own elemental powers called Scions. Their mission aligns with his, put an end to AI rule. Yet the quest looks more like a suicide mission while Gunnar struggles to tap into a power greater than himself. This debut sci-fi takes readers on a thrilling adventure with unforgettable characters and a heavy dose of fantasy. Author Clint Hall is a storyteller, speaker, and podcast host. Known for narratives that instill a sense of hope, wonder, and adventure, Clint's work has been published across multiple anthologies and magazines. And he was recently named a double finalist for short fiction in the 2021 Realm Awards. His podcast is called The Experience, Conversations with Creatives, and is available on all major platforms. This is Bria Burton with your futuristic fiction fix, signing off.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Looking for inspiration? Looking for something that will intrigue you? Then this book is for you. Jim Lamb's poems start out as caterpillars, creepy, crawly, and raw. Then a miracle happens as they transform into colorful, bright, and conspicuous works of art. You can find Jim's new book of poetry, Hurting Butterflies, at Amazon.com. It's the perfect gift for the book lover in your life, even if it's you. Hurting Butterflies, the perfect holiday gift, available on Amazon. Get Hurting Butterflies.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest. Oh boy, oh boy. I love historical fiction, and I am glad that this one, well, we're talking a little bit about a pandemic, and I'm happy it is set in the past. I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Patrice McDonough. Hi, Patrice.
Hi, Patsy. I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, this is fun. This is going to be fun.
Okay. Great.
So,
and I'm happy to hear you love historical fiction. That's wonderful.
Oh, I do. It's my favorite. And when I get my sister involved, she loves this book, by the way. She loves this book, and which is a great compliment because in our area, she's known as the connoisseur of cozy mysteries. So, Murder by Lamplight. Oh, now that's a great title. And the minute she saw it, actually, she grabbed it out of my hand. She's like that. It's like when a Carol J. Perry book arrives at the house, she grabs that one out of my hand. I never can read it first. So let's talk about this. And not only that, it's set in England, you know, because I lived in England. Everything about this book is just great. So tell us about it. And I think you have a real winner here in Murder by Lamplight.
Oh, great. Thank you. I hope your prediction turns out to be true. Well, it's set in sort of mid-Victorian London. It's the 1860s. Actually, a very specific year, because you did mention the pandemic issue. It's set during the year that the last great cholera epidemic hit London. And I don't know exactly, I was trying to think of the genesis of this, but I thought, gee, wouldn't it be interesting to have sort of two killers stalking London? One is the murderer, and the other would be this disease. Now, this sounded like a great idea back in the summer of 2019. A year later, in the middle of COVID, I started to wonder. But I think a good thing sort of happened along the way. The epidemic in question, the cholera epidemic, really is over by the time the novel starts. So it's sort of in the background of events. And, you know, slowly the reader begins to kind of get an inkling that somehow the motive for the murders and this recent epidemic are linked. So it was also, I thought, tremendous fun to set it in the 1860s, because this was just the dawn, the late 1850s, 1860s, of the women's movement in England. And it's also the time period, about a 10-year time period, when the very first female doctors started to appear on the medical list. So I thought, disease, epidemic, mystery. It would be cool to have a female doctor and a Scotland Yard detective somehow throw in together to solve the mystery.
Well, so I think it's clever. I think it's as you said, it's the I like this period of Victorian history particularly. Mm-hmm. I think it's just after Charlotte Bronte's books, right. And Emily Bronte's book, and the Bronte girls, their books have come out. It's a different, as you said, things are changing. People are looking at women's occupations, because prior to that, the only job a woman could have would be to be a governess. And right. So it was a big change. It was a big, you know, just the mindset had to change. And so I love this period. I know we have a lot of, you know, there's different periods. People don't realize that, you know, at that time, when in the early Victorian period, mm-hmm. it was a different world than what happened when after, you know, after the prince died and sort of
right.
everything mm-hmm. Victorian changed. So I think it's a great story. So tell us, well, of course, we have always, you know, the love interest, and I think that you've done uh-huh. a beautiful job here. So tell us about, well, first of all, we'll talk about you just generally, you know, Julia Lewis is you right. come out with a great character. So tell us about your characters.
Yeah, Julia she comes from a medical family. Her grandfather is a doctor. Her father was also a doctor, but he has died when Julia was a child. And she, you know, at various points in the book, she says, I know other people wouldn't understand this, but just there's something in me that has to be a doctor. But in this time period, no medical school in Britain would allow women into their program. That's not going to happen for about another generation. But oddly enough, across the Atlantic, over in the United States, there were quite a few ways that women could get into medical school, including two medical colleges just for women, one in Boston and one in Philadelphia. And my fictional Julia ends up going to Philadelphia, where she does have some family roots. Her grandmother was an American from Philadelphia, so she has relatives there, so it becomes kind of a natural fit. She does experience some professional, not surprising, right, challenges, in that she finds her private practice isn't exactly flourishing, but she opens a clinic for the indigent in the East End, in Whitechapel specifically. So that really, I think, gets most of her, absorbs most of her professional energy. But, you know, she's a very bright woman. She's smart as a whip. You know, I tried to write her, and I hope it comes across that way. She does have a kind of sense of humor at times about her plight, you know. But she does sometimes find it a little wearing having to kind of explain herself. And when of course, she first encounters, you know, Inspector Tennant, who will be her, you know, partner in all of these investigations. I mean, he's just thrown for a loop, you know, by her. And it takes him a while he comes to fairly quickly appreciate her professional skills. But it takes a little bit of a while for them to work through, you know, a dynamic where they can work together. Definitely. I try not to make him too much of like a male chauvinist curmudgeon, you know, either. She's impatient with him at times because she finds, you know, she'd like it to move along a little faster. But, you know, hey, it's 1866. And the relationships between men and women are just so different from what they are today. That's for sure. That's kind of what I was thinking of as the dynamic between the two of them. They have things that are very contrasting. I think their upbringings, their families particularly, make them, you know, Julia was raised in a very warm family, not so much Tennant. But one thing that they have in common, which I think is interesting, I wrote them both as sort of outsiders in their profession. And as over time, Tennant comes to realize that, you know, the Scotland Yard of its first generation or so, definitely recruited from what you might call working class coppers. And Tennant, from a slightly different military background, a professional background, feels a little bit, out of his element there and hard to fit in. Of course, Julia, by definition, is out of her element as a female doctor. So that's one thing that I think they have in common and creates a link between the two of them.
Well, you must have had fun doing the research. I love research.
Oh, yes. Me, absolutely. You know, I was a history teacher for, oh my goodness, more than 3 decades. So I have absolutely no problem, you know, sitting down and, you know, reading. You know, my problem, I'll tell you about this, is stopping the research and starting the writing. You know?
I know.
You have to force yourself.
That's why I have a 200,000-word book.
There you go.
That I can't get published because I can't stop doing the research.
You can't keep doing it. Absolutely, yes. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it is such a, you know, the Victorian period is such a great period, I think, for a mystery. You know, there's so much, you know, proper, you know, and rectitude on the surface, and then underneath there's all this other stuff going on. You know, all that fog, all that gaslight. It just seems like the perfect setting for a murder. So that was fun too. Poring over maps that I was able to find a source that reprinted actual maps of all the different neighborhoods in London. So that was fantastic. I love maps too, and I'm poring over it to, you know, get a sense of the geography, you know, of the time. And that was a lot of fun.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned maps. That is one of the problems with my 200,000-page book. My book is set in 1875. And part of it is in India. So I studied the maps of this town in India, and I could draw you the entire layout of the city with every street. And I don't think there's one Indian. There are a billion Indians, but I bet you could go to India and ask one of them, could you draw a map of Baroda in 1875? And not one of them could do it, but I could.
I think you'd win that bet. You would win that bet for sure. That they couldn't.
I mean, I have a whole big trunk of maps. I collect them. I love them because, especially with the ones, you know, old maps that take you back, and you get that excitement of. There's something about maps that just drive me crazy. I love them. I can spend hours on them.
And the old ones are so beautiful. The illustrations all around the edges. That's really nifty too. I may be the only person who has an 1846 map of New Jersey on the wall in their kitchen.
I love you. I love you. You are my kind of person.
Absolutely. Not to mention the map of Paris in the year of the revolution, 1789, that I have in my bedroom. So a little bit weird.
No, it means you're brilliant. You're delightful, you're charming, you're extraordinary. That's what it means to be.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, yeah. Murder by Lamplight. That is, it's just great. I'm so happy for you. It's so exciting always that, you know, to come out with a new book and to come out with an, I get so excited, and I'm so happy for, you know, Kensington's done a beautiful job for you.
Oh, they have. They're dolls. I can't say enough about Kensington. The editors there, it's just everybody is wonderful. Well, speaking of titles, I just wanted to mention, I love your title, Joy on Paper, because number one, I'm a paper girl when it comes to books. And number two, I'm feeling pretty joyful today and thankful to you for inviting me, for sure.
Well, I love when I'm on, you know, I get people on their release date, their big day. I'm part of your history now. And now, of course,
absolutely.
Now we're also going to be friends because we're map people.
So. Oh, absolutely. Yes. And you're my very first interview post, you know, publication. So thank you. Thank you for that. Well,
you're going to have lots of fun. And I think everybody who reads this book, they will enjoy it. It's just very well written. I love that you were a history teacher. My favorite teacher, I in school, I had, So I didn't do very well. I did well in school, but I didn't, get along with a lot of them. Because I was reading Perry Mason paperback mysteries when I was 5 years old. So they didn't always, teachers didn't always understand me. But my history teacher loved me because I was like, and she was also a math person, which is why I loved her.
It's funny the connections that pop up.
The only other teacher I loved was my Latin teacher. I'm thrilled that I got to talk to you and that I'm your first one to interview you, because you're going to be interviewed now. Well, this is going to be a long running series, I think.
Well, there are two more that I've already written, and I guess we'll see where we go from there. So, but that is very cool. So at least we can be definitely sure there are two more adventures in the Julia Lewis Tennant mystery. It's actually named for her. Kensington branded it for her, the Dr. Julia Lewis mystery series. So, yeah.
I'm sure there will be. I remember, the first guest in the studio, when you say about Joy on Paper, when I started Joy on Paper, it's going to be the 9th anniversary next month.
Oh, my. And
when I started it in 2015, my first guest was a Kensington author, Carol J. Perry. She was the first one to come into the studio, and she's a Kensington author, and that was for her book one, and she's now doing book 15 in her Witch City Mysteries. So...
Well, that's a good omen.
It is a good omen. And so we will continue. I'm sure I will be seeing you every year.
I hope so.
And so sometimes twice a year. Because Carol started a second series, and so now I have to see her.
So
whenever you have a new release date, you're going to come back here, because we're going to have fun talking about maps and about this wonderful book and the entire series. I think it's really great, and I'm really thrilled that you were on Joy on Paper. And do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes. What is my website?
Well, you do, actually. And it's funny. Why is it 1789?
It's like not being able to remember your phone number. Patrice McDonough, my full name, 1789.com. Because actually the first book I ever wrote, which was actually just a summer reading project for my students, and I self-published, was about the French Revolution. So when I made a website, I double love you.
I have 200 books about Napoleon.
Oh, my goodness.
So when I saw 1789, I my heart, I hoped. I knew it wasn't your birth year.
No,
people knew that. So I said, "Oh well." I mean, I am
That's
like
funny.
It's crazy. It's absolutely wonderful. The first thought when I saw 1789, I thought of Napoleon. I thought of the Revolution.
French Revolution, absolutely. Patsy, we are so simpatico. Maps, French Revolution, Napoleon, Victorian times.
Oh,
I mean, it's all there.
I call you a golden thread. I have these connections to authors that sometimes are unexpected, but they make them very. It makes you very special to me. And so much so that I know that I'm going to be doing a video for you, because I really. I get a kick out of it. So, anyway, I want to, again,
wonderful.
Thank you for being on Joy on Paper. Thank you, Kensington. Thank you, Jesse and Larissa, all of you people at Kensington. Thank you for sending Patrice McDonough. And that's how you pronounce it, right?
That's right.
Okay, Patrice McDonough. It is, you don't hear a lot of Patrice, you know, mine, Patsy with a Z. But Patrice, also, it's distinctive. I like it.
Oh, good. Okay. Thank you, Patsy, with the team. This has been such a pleasure, and I was feeling nervous about it, and you made it easy.
Oh, my goodness, you're going to be a hit with everybody, okay?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye. Oh, that's so nice. I like her. Oh, I like her. Okay. Kensington author. And thinking of Kensington authors, I'm thinking of Carol J. Perry, who I know is writing today. She's writing today. She's writing every day. You know, when you have two series going, you are really writing every day. So special hello to Carol J. Perry, who she does actually listen to the program in between doing 1,000 words a day. She is one of these authors who really took that idea and has run with it, which has definitely turned out very well, because when you think about it, she started in 2015 with me, and she's been writing and writing and writing, and now she has this fantastic Witch City Mystery Series, book number 15. She's taken us to Salem for years and years and years, and that is a wonderful series. You can get that one. I really wish they would pick her up. This would be a wonderful series, refreshing, a different kind of series. We need on television, we need some things with like new blood. We need something fun. I'm so tired of so many. I get so bored with the ordinary stuff. And Witch City Mysteries would be great. But she also does a series called Haunted Haven, which I really love because it's set right in sort of my backyard, Florida, St. Petersburg, Clearwater area. And in that one, she has an old inn where, let's say, there are some people who never checked out. And we had in this area so many famous celebrities. We have them now, but you don't see them because they're all hiding away in their zillion-dollar houses. But in those days, they were out there. And my favorite, of course, is Babe Ruth. And he would play golf. And every day I drive past the golf course where he used to play golf. And I look over at that golf course and I think, oh, babe, I wish I could see you as a ghost. Okay, Big Ed's playing my music. I have to get out of here. Anyway, thank you, everybody. Thank you for your notes. Keep them coming. And thank you, Big Ed, for all you do for me. We got everything organized today. Okay. I guess it's run out of time. Bye-bye now, everybody. Have a wonderful day. And we'll be back on Thursday with another great program and talking more about Joy on Paper's 9th anniversary. Bye-bye now.